This is the Freedom Fiends broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker in an undisclosed location in the rural wild mountain west in the occupied states of America. And we're also broadcasting through the rotating Freedom Fiends satellite, the high above financial beast plaza in the Mission District of Santa something in Baja, California. That's it, right? I don't know. On the corner of Trash View and Nada Vista. So where are you, Phil? What's up, Phil Warmoth?
I'm in the woods of Maine. I'm looking out the window right now, and it's rainy, and the humidity is about, I don't know, 70-something percent.
700%.
You know, I'm in the JIT production bunker right now, not in the shed studio.
Oh, you're so not out good. In the, okay. Yeah, is it probably too hot in the summer out in your studio,
It's too hot, yeah. The microphone would melt.
Yeah, when it's really hot, I joke that birds are exploding. I just picture them going, poof. So we actually saw this documentary. It was about like birds exploding in Arizona. And it was, well, they were finding like scorched dead birds on the ground. And they thought it was some kind of, you know, alien pulse wave or something. But it was actually a solar power plant that concentrated with thousands of mirrors concentrated to a small area up on a pole, and that heated up, and then they drive a steam turbine with that and generate electricity. But the birds would, you know, just when they were flying over, they would just fly through this this field of concentrated sunlight and catch on fire and, you know, fly for 50 feet or 100, I don't know, a ways, and then just die. It was weird. It's creepy. Unintended consequences.
That's a problem for the neighbors. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. If you have flaming birds coming down in your house, it's kind of seems biblical or something, you know, like a plague.
What about flaming neighbors? Is that a thing too?
I've had flaming neighbors in San Francisco. I mean, I was fine with them flaming, but, you know, flaming quietly out of my face. But I don't know. In California, everyone wants to push everything in your face. You know, it's just being themselves is a political act. And it's like, no, man, you're going to frighten the horses. Go away. Well, they won't go away. So I just moved. I left.
Right.
Yeah.
You moved where you did. I moved into the woods. It all works, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have to impress the moose here.
The moose.
We're really not impressed, man.
We have moose here, too, in Wyoming. Did you see the thing I wrote for Kip to read?
I did.
Yeah.
So I got a couple questions.
Okay,
so
let's do it live. Forget it. We'll do it live.
Sure,
yeah.
Man.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I read through it once, and I kind of get it's kind of like an infomercial type thing. But what was your inspiration for that?
Oh, just solo tinkling minor key piano is something I've identified and named. Whenever there's an ad that's trying to tug an ad or a documentary or any kind of video that's trying to, or even radio, audio only, that's trying to tug at your heartstrings and get you to act in a way they want you to act, or get you to mainly to pull out your checkbook or credit card number, they will use solo tinkling minor key piano, sometimes acoustic guitar too. But it's a certain kind of piano music that's very sad and stirring, and it's such a cliche. I can't believe no one points this out. So I'm doing a song that's going to have solo tinkling minor key piano that's going to be a parody, basically, of those kind of commercials. But it's going to sound like one of those commercials. And Kip has the perfect voice for a stirring infomercial.
Yeah. You know, I didn't really know what to call it. But as soon as I hear that on one of those extended infomercial ads, I immediately turn the channel.
Yep.
It's just like instinctual.
Yep. Yeah. Solo tinkling minor key piano. I mean, this is talk radio. It'll probably happen during this show at some point, you know.
Hey, you never know.
Yeah.
Please pull out your checkbooks and donate.
Yeah.
We got bills to pay. We got to keep these studios running. We got to keep the
keep the lights on in the shed.
Keep those solar farms going, man.
Flying flaming birds. Yes. For just pennies a day, you can help the flaming birds flame on. Yeah.
So last night, I sorry, I didn't mean
it. Oh, did you like it? And will you have him? Will you record it?
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. Oh, absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
I really liked it a lot. I think it's in the. It seems like we always have one of those type songs.
A fake commercial or a fake. Yeah. Well, you're having to record fake something too. What are you having him record?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have him record the fanfare for the common worm. That was,
man, I almost spit soda.
I love it.
On my monitor.
Sorry. Yeah.
That's good.
So this was one really, like, I normally when I sit down to write something, it takes me a while and I process it and I leave it and I come back to it. But this one, for some reason, was giving me a lot of problems because I actually, it had a kind of alien theme to it, you know, and I wasn't really sure where it was going. And then you sent me a song file, music file, entitled Fanfare for the Common Worm, and then that just opened it all up for me. So I totally took it in a whole different direction, and I think it really worked. So
yep.
I love talking about the process of writing, and I think
me
we
too.
Had a really
me too.
Good one because we complement each other, you know.
Yes, we do. You're looking fine today, Phil. How are you feeling?
Thank you. I'm feeling peckish. How about you?
Peckish. What does that mean? Sounds irritated.
I don't know. I'm kind of hungry, though. Maybe that's what it means.
Peaked? Peaked is hungry and weak.
So, right? Yeah. So, you know, speaking of feeling peckish, I was feeling peckish yesterday morning. You know, yesterday morning was one of those mornings where everything went wrong. So,
it means hungry. I just looked it up.
I thought it did.
Yeah. All right.
My first step out of bed, I stepped in cat puke.
Ugh.
That was an indication of where my day was going. So
yeah.
I was feeling peckish. I threw some bread in the toaster and buttered it all up and was ready to eat it. And I noticed it was all moldy.
Ugh.
Then I
maybe the cat was eating it. Maybe that's why he threw up.
Maybe, man. It's one of those things. So I usually come. I fire up my computer. I'm usually up about 6. So I try to check in and communicate with everybody in the morning because things get
I call that checking my traps. DJ calls that checking.
I like that.
Yeah, check my traps, see what I caught overnight.
Well, I was checking my traps, and 2 out of my 3 traps wouldn't even open up, man. The same thing happened to me this morning. So like, I, you know, this is when technology fails, it makes me just think that I could live without it. You know,
You do live in a windowless bunker in Maine in the woods.
It's true, and to be honest with you, I'm pretty happy. You know, I'm happy when the grid goes down and the moose come to talk to me.
I don't know if I'm happy when the grid goes down. I think a lot of people. I think you're kidding, but
I think I am too. Yeah. I think I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, I know a lot of people. I know a lot of people who are like, "Yeah, man, civil war, it's coming. It's going to be great. It'll reset everything." First of all, it won't reset everything. Secondly, civil wars are horrible. Civil wars are, you know, every person for themselves and people just murdered in the streets. I mean, if you like bleeding babies and women and children and men and animals in the street eating them, that's civil war, you know. So we don't want that.
Right.
But it's amazing to me how many people think that like that would reset civilization. You know, like that's kind of the plot of the movie Fight Club. Like they want to, you know, blow up buildings to end the credit card companies and reset everyone's debt. And they think that'll make everything perfect. And that's actually the same plot in the movie, Mr. Robot, but they don't want to do it with bombs in that. They want to erase all the data and then, put an internet worm into the building where they keep all the paper backups of it. So all of the hard drives just go so fast, they start fires and burn up the paper backups. Which is kind of cheesy that they used the same MacGuffin in that show that was in Fight Club. It's so obviously Fight Club. And there's even a scene that's kind of like the end of Fight Club where like the guy's about to shoot himself, but then he thinks it's like someone else about to shoot him outside of him. But it's really his his alter ego. But good show otherwise. Both of those shows, actually, the movie and the show. Fight Club, the movie. But it's ridiculous. First of all, you know, violence doesn't solve things. Second of all, if you blew up all of the credit card company buildings, it wouldn't end the record of credit card debt. Like that stuff is replicated off over dozens of servers around the world, you know. Thirdly, we wouldn't go to a Garden of Eden paradise. I actually saw this show today with DJ. It was great. It was a YouTube video that was really well researched, and I believe most of it. And it was about, you know, what would happen if people just died, if just the human race, just like a switch, everyone died, you know. And it started with like, oh, planes would crash, cars would crash, machinery would, you know, run until 3 or 4 days when the power goes out because the coal plants aren't being fired. And it you know, everybody thinks it would be a a paradise. It would actually be a paradise in about 100 to 150 years. But for most of the time, and especially the first 30 years, it would get a lot worse. because there's all these things that, like, because of the technological quote-unquote advancements, advancements of mankind, there are systems in place that people run that if people stopped running, you know, things like plants that make chemicals that keep toxic chemicals in huge, you know, Olympic 50 Olympic swimming pool size reservoirs of these chemicals that have to be like kept a certain temperature and pressure, you know, about a week later when the power stopped, those that would all leak out. There would be fires everywhere. There would be, you know, overgrown this and that. Satellites would fall from the earth and start fires. There'd be no one to put out forest fires. The earth would just be a burning toxic mass for, you know, 30 to 50 years, and then it would start getting better too. In about 150 years, it would be – you'd be hard-pressed to find evidence there were ever people here. But it would take a while.
You know, of all the apps I have on my phone, the one I don't think I could live without is Cell 411. Cell 411 is a great free app that allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with things like crime, emergencies, setting up a neighborhood watch, activism, or even helping protect your kids from bullies on the street. Cell 411 allows for real-time chat with your cells and provides turn-by-turn directions to your exact location. It also allows for real-time video streaming, which is then stored on the Cell 411 servers in case a roving gang of thugs or the police, but then I repeat myself, attempt to destroy or take your phone away from you. Cell 411 can be found on the Google Play Store or on iTunes or at getcell411.com. Get Cell 411 today.
Yeah, custodians of the of our world.
And yeah. Look what we're doing. I think that's an accurate term. And I think that a lot of people who live in flaming places where I used to live on the West Coast, especially, think that that would be a bad – they hate that term. You know, but there are people that use iPhones incessantly and use technology incessantly to condemn technology and, you know, progress and, you know, machinery and things. So
I think there's a there's kind of a equilibrium that some of us at least have found where we were not so disconnected from our technology, but yet we are connected to the world around us and try to keep it real and –
try to keep it real. And, yeah.
Try to keep it real. Yeah.
What does that mean?
I mean, I think there's so, well, for me, when I, I'm driving down the big city road here, the one that we have, and I see people, they're not even looking when they're walking because they're connected to their phone. They're not keeping it real. They're not even aware of their surroundings. I think humans are going to mutate into like these postureless effluvium kind of blobs of mass and cells just attached to some piece of electronics.
Like Jabba the Hutt with electrodes stuck in it.
Yeah. I see it. I see it. It's going to happen.
So we did a show before where we said people had stopped evolving, which is true because there's no survival of the fittest anymore, basically because of technology and safety nets and medicine. You know, the weak aren't weeded out anymore. So we're not devolving. We're not evolving, but you're suggesting we're devolving, I think, with that part.
Yeah. I mean, just think about it. You know, when was the last time you were at the grocery store and a sweet little old lady asked you to reach up on that shelf to pull down a can of beans that she couldn't reach? You know, she would have died back in the day. You know, but no, here we are. We're enabling.
No, Beck. You know, sorry. Are you advocating for letting the weak and the infirm and the old get eaten by the wolves?
I think there's something to say for that.
Wow.
I haven't really thought this through, but, you know, I mean, think about it. I mean,
careful. You choose your words, man. Someone's going to quote you and take you out of context here. Do you really think You really think? I mean, I think that in the old days, the elderly person would have been taken care of and protected by her family.
I would like to think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that was common, especially in, I mean, in Asian cultures, you know, supposedly old people are venerated. I don't know that that's so much true anymore. There's actually a huge problem in Japan of, like young men just – I don't know if it's a problem, but a phenomena in Japan of like young men just don't want to get married and they don't want to hustle and play the game and have kids and work as a corporate man. And a lot of them are just getting like kind of lazy jobs, living with their parents or, you know, living. I mean, I actually saw this documentary, like a lot of them live in cubicles in internet cafes, you know, and they have some kind of like web-based job where they can do, you know, they get paid over the, like they don't have to leave this box basically. And they just sit in there and smoke cigarettes and work on the computer. And there's a name for them. They're called grass eaters. You know, it's like they don't eat meat. They're virgins by choice, and they don't want to play the game. So basically, like Japan's population is getting really elderly because not as many people are having kids.
and think about it, you know, as a matter of fact, I just revisited your old ancestral home in Westfield, New York, and
my old ancestral home.
Yeah, who can even maintain those big houses anymore? I think that's a big indication right there.
I know. The house that huge – you saw the house I grew up in. It's pretty big.
Yeah.
It's 3,800 square feet. It was built in 1850. And then it has a garage, an external like separate building that's actually bigger than most houses. We call it – it was a carriage house, you know, in the 1800s. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's huge. I mean, you can park – it's got a really wide door. You could park four cars in there. Easily, you know, two and two, I've cleared everything out of it. And then there's an upstairs that's just as big. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that place sold for not a lot of money. It sold for, I think it was 100 and I'll look it up. It was under 200 grand and it's gigantic. Like in San Francisco, that place would cost $20 million probably, or, you know, in Cleveland, it would cost $2 million. Yeah.
Yeah. The first thing I noticed was it was broken up into a couple apartments.
Well, it always was.
Meters.
Yeah.
There. Yeah. Okay.
But let's see. Zillow.com. Let's see what it sold for. Oh, that house sold last year. That house sold less than a year ago for $114,000.
Wow.
That house is huge, man.
And it was very well maintained, too. I
mean, yeah.
It was in really good shape.
Yep. Wow. For 1850. There's actually... In one of the windows upstairs, somebody in like 1865, Clara Eason of the Eason Hall people, you know, Eason Hall's the, it's like the town hall in Westfield. It's called Eason Hall. That's the name of the building. Oh, and yeah, the Easons were some of the early people that built that town. And, Clara Eason wrote her name with a diamond in the window upstairs. And it's still like unbroken, you know, over 100-year-old piece of glass. It's amazing.
That's cool.
Yep. She put her name and her date, and I think she said when she got married or something. I think she was celebrating getting married. Maybe she was trying to like get help. Like it was her honeymoon, and she's trying to like carve a message in the glass with her wedding ring. Oh, that's dire. I don't know. Clara Eason was probably a fine woman and probably was married to a fine man. I don't know that anything. It's weird carving your name in a – Well, it's your property. You can do what you want with it, you know. Although, I don't know if she lived there. I think she was a guest, but she was probably so famous. They're like, oh, you can carve your name in our window. Do it.
Maybe she suspected her diamond wasn't real.
Oh, yeah. And back then, there weren't fake diamonds. So if it wasn't real, it would not cut glass. The glass would cut it probably. You know, I don't know why that house is so cheap because I'm looking at other houses in that area and – You know, like here's a house that's about that big, that's more modern. It's like $300,000 in the same town I'd much rather live in the one I grew up in. It has much more class and style, personality.
Plus, it was like right down the street from the library.
From the James T. Prednisone. Yeah, library.
Yeah. So I got to say, man, one of my main missions going back to Western New York this summer was to go to that library, which I never set foot in, by the way, before, and try to find one squirrel that we've immortalized in a song.
We celebrate in song. We wrote a folk song about it, a synthesizer folk song.
I like to think that.
Ode to a Grecian squirrel. Yes.
I set foot in that place, and immediately my eyes were just drawn to... You weren't kidding. I mean, there were probably 30 different stuffed animals, anything from eagles to squirrels, you name it. There were a couple animals. I didn't even know what they were, man.
Yeah.
But I had to find the squirrel. So I went to the basement. I worked my way up.
Did you ask anybody? Did you talk to anyone there?
No, this was a covert operation.
Ah.
So yeah. I, I got up to the second floor. It's kind of like a balcony.
That's great. It's there, a very there it was. You have to set the stage. It's a very opulent library. The building and the collections for a town of 3,000 people. I mean, it's better than the library in Casper, Wyoming, where there's 50,000 people. Yeah,
and it's, I would have to say it's probably one of the top five libraries I've ever been to.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's amazing.
And that was just. That was just without spending a lot of time.
And it's for people. We're joking about the name. It's not really the James T. Pregnazone Library. It's the Patterson Library in Westfield, New York, on South Portage Street. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Check it out. It's worth going. It's worth going. You know, a couple hours out of your way, even if you like libraries and you're ever in that part of the country.
Yeah, if you find yourself on the wine trail, you know, just stop by. It's great. Go to the second floor in the middle. Of the stacks, the middle section of the stacks, you will find one said squirrel.
Yep. Yeah, hang on a sec.
Top of the book.
Go ahead. In order what?
Yeah, it was way up. It was way up on top of a bookcase. So I looked around. I found something to stand on. I grabbed like a little table, and I'm taking shots of this squirrel. And I realized some guy was looking at me, and he didn't blow my cover, but I don't know what he thought. I knew what I thought.
He hadn't heard the song. He wasn't hip. He doesn't know the Biptunia.
He's not hip to
the Biptunia Vantana connection. Hey, you know, I never thought about Biptunia and Vantana kind of sound like they belong together. Yeah.
We'll talk about them, man. I think these guys are pretty cool.
What are your impressions?
I like their energy.
Yeah.
I guess we should explain
who they are. Vantana Row is a band from the Bay Area, San Francisco. Don't hold that against them. They want to get out. I mean, they could get out easily. They live in a van. They could just turn it on and drive. But they have, you know.
So that's where Vantana comes from.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And it's,
they're going to get in a van and they're going to go to Montana.
No, it was actually, there was like something called Santana Row. I don't know if it was a building or something. Oh. And they were doing word association like we do where, you know, like for a whole day, they were just adding van to everything because they live in a van. And they just came up with the Vantana Row. I love Vantana Row. I told them that they were thinking of changing it at one point. I was like, no, you got to keep it. And not only keep it as your band name, but you should use it for everything. Like, it sounds like a publishing company. It sounds like a clothing line. Yeah. It sounds like a bunch of apartments, you know,
right.
You could do everything with it. So it could be a detective agency. You could drive around the country in a van solving mysteries. But I met this kid, Jamie. So it's a husband and wife. It's Jamie Blaze or Blaze, B-L-A-Z-E, and his wife, Volley Blaze, Blaze. And I knew him as a different last name, but Jamie is his name. And I knew him when he was 7 because I was dating his mother. And she and I, after we broke up, we're still friends. And she was a big fan of my music. And she gave him a tape of my band Slish, this red cassette tape. It was we had this band. It was right after I got clean in 94, 95, 96. And it was like me, my friend Bean and I had this band. We'd written a bunch of songs together and they were really good. And some kind of pros got involved with us. This guy, Michael Urbano, who plays on a lot of top 10 records, played with Cracker, played with Sarah. Who's that one? Sarah. I don't know. The one that dated the bicycle player, that bicycle rider that was on steroids. What's his name?
You got me.
Yeah. Bad. Anyway, people know who I'm talking about. But yeah, Michael Urbano and this guy, David Immergluck, who now plays in Counting Crows. And this guy, Davey Farragher, who played in a lot of bands with those guys, wanted to like produce us. So, you know, Immergluck and Urbano played guitar and drums. I played guitar and sang. Bean sang bass and sang. And we did a demo tape and it's amazing. I mean, it's like the best demo tape ever, or one of them. And Urbano paid for the studio time and was going to try to get us a deal. And then like he wouldn't be our drummer. We'd hire another drummer and then he'd take 10% or something like that. It was going to be something like that. And we recorded the tape and we actually won this contest in the it was like a battle of the bands and I've never been in a battle of the bands. Actually, it wasn't like you play a band. It was like you send a tape in. It was the SF Weekly paper. And the contest was like, you know, we'll press 500 cassettes of your tape. And we won that. And we pressed 500 cassettes and we picked red because we felt like it would stand out across the room. Red tape, cassette tape. And Jamie got it and he put it on YouTube, and I don't even have a copy of this tape. One day about a while back, I was Googling Slish. I was like, you know, oh, and the band broke up because Bean and I were like crazy. We're off drugs for very little time. We're newly sober, and we like, I mean, you've seen me crazy, you know, 20 some years sober. I'm kind of crazy. I'm not crazy, but I'm like, I get, you know, and that's, you're not even in the same room with me. So these people were in the same room with me, and I was a lot more raw and hadn't really developed any life skills yet sober. And the band broke up and we missed this up. I mean, this guy could have gotten us signed and really wanted to, and we had something worth signing, and we scared them off. We were just so raw that no one, it was kind of funny because most bands that are good have more people every time they play. We had less people every time we play because we'd fight on stage, but it wasn't like cool, like, you know, the Clash punching each other on stage. It was like between songs, like, you know, a couple cranky old women or something. And yeah. So the guys just left and went on to bigger and better things and played with, you know, Todd Rundgren or whoever. I don't know. But so, yeah, so that happened. But the tape was like, you know, we sold probably 100 of them and gave 400 of them away, and they were out there. And I never had one. I didn't have one. But this guy, Jamie, who's now 29, put it on YouTube. And I was like, man, cool. And we started chatting about 2 weeks ago, a little less than 2 weeks ago. And he and I and his wife on speakerphone have talked about 4 or 5 hours a day for 2 weeks. Yeah. And like, I'm all up in their stuff now. I'm managing their band. I'm trying to get them deals. I'm promoting their street team, their art. I'm buying them Biptunia t-shirts to wear in rock videos. I'm sending them some equipment. I sent them a keyboard, sent them my old keyboard. I sent them the keyboard that I played on the first two Biptunia records, you know, that kind of long one, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So send them some microphones, send them Ben Stone's microphones. And it's really fun. I really like them. They have great energy, great kids. They live in a van. They're Vantana Row. People should go help them out on go to their website, Vantana Row. Just Google VantanaRow.com or Vantana Row and check them out. Send them $3 a month on Patreon or something. They'll get some gas and maybe they can get out of the Bay Area. And they're like, they're a political blank slate, and they're not political at all. And I like that because everyone in California is political. They have to be. And these guys aren't. So that's cool.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I guess that's one of the things that I really like about them.
Yeah.
I like their songs are short and punchy.
Yeah. Yep.
You get done listening and you're like, what
was that? There? What happened? Yeah. What happened?
And then you go back and you listen again, and then you put it together. And
yeah,
I like I said, I really like their energy, and I wish them the best. And maybe coming their van, maybe coming to a town near you soon. Who knows?
Maybe near you. They're going to go on tour. They're actually going to go on tour and not book gigs in clubs. They're just going to go yell at people on the street waiting to see other bands. Yeah,
that's their MO. Yeah.
But they actually that they have a website, they actually – I helped them make their website too, and I helped them set up their Patreon and kind of – I push them a lot. I'm kind of like an AA sponsor. You know, they're not drunks or junkies, but I'm kind of like a sponsor to them. Actually, he grew up in AA in 12-step. Like his mother – I met her in 12-step meetings and she's been sober forever too. And we were like recently sober when we met, and you know, everyone around us in recovery was just boring and like, and she and I were like, rock and roll, man, we're sober. Let's party, you know, let's party sober. And, you know, great person. His mom's like a really cool lady. And, he's just really, he's like her a lot, and he's really cool. And I dig him, and I dig their energy. I like where they're going. I like where we're going to send them. We're going to send them around. I'm not sending them anywhere, but they're planning on going around the country. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things I want to do the Patreon for, is to raise gas money so they can go around the country. And they do shows. They play in clubs occasionally, like they're playing tomorrow night in a club, but they play about a 15-minute set in clubs, and they play about a 1-minute set on the street. They find out where some big band is playing, and they drive up to where people are waiting in line to get in to see some famous band, where there's like 100 people out on the street, and they just play like a 1-minute concert. You know, they pre-record the computer parts and then play it over their stereo of their van and point the speakers out the window. And then he plays a two-piece drum kit, like a snare, a cymbal, and a bass drum. And then she screams or sings, And yeah, they do these like kind of assaultive, beautiful concerts for about 60 seconds. And then they throw CDs at the people, and people like run over and catch them because it's so weird. They're like, what is that? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you like that. There's a great YouTube video. Yeah. That you really get an idea. But I love it. I love the hit and run.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's what we would have done if we'd had our act together more back in the day. You know, I didn't have a vehicle until I was like 25. But yeah. Did you have a car in Jamestown?
I did, but I got so many good things. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still look for that car when I go back home. There was only two like it in town, and the other one was my arch enemy. His was blue with white stripes. Mine was silver with black stripes.
And what was it?
We saw each other. It was an interesting car. It was a 75 Chevy Laguna, which was a special edition like Malibu, but I built it all up, man. I had one of the fastest cars in town, but like that's what it got me. It got me a stack of tickets. I had to sell it.
I'll bet.
I had.
So you and I were in this band, The Armless Children, in college in the 80s, early 80s. Why was it called The Armless Children?
It was after a poem I wrote, actually. It was funny, too, because there's no kind of like what you said about your tape there. I don't have a copy of the original poem, but I was talking to a friend of mine who was around in that time period, and I was telling him what you and I are doing, and he remembered like the first stanza of the poem, and it was something like, I'm an armless child in a candy store. I'm locked in. Someone shut the door. Look, they say, but you cannot touch. If I had an arm, I'd break my crutch.
That's it.
I don't even know what that means.
I know. Well, it's, I like it. It's like alienation. We should use that again. You should put that in something. I thought it was I've been locked out, not locked in. Wasn't it?
No, locked in. You're locked in. Can you imagine? You're locked in.
I know.
You see everything that you want, but you can't touch it.
Why don't you put that in something? Write another poem. Right? Like you don't even have to connect it mainly, but just out of out of respect to our humble roots.
Right. So, yeah. So tell people about what we did, maybe even more what we didn't do.
Well, we played in a band. I was playing with this guy, Tony Yannick, who was a drummer. I played guitar. You did poetry over it. Did you ever play? Well, we had a bass player after a while. It was Doug Brunskill. Did you ever play when he was playing with us?
Yeah.
Because I remember going with him. I don't think you were there at most of these, though, but he and I – he worked at Chautauqua that summer, and I lived in Chautauqua. He worked at the amphitheater as an assistant sound man.
I worked there too. I worked at the Boys and Girls Club that summer.
Oh. You know, the Boys and Girls Club was like the first place I was ever bullied as a kid. And it was like, it was a, you know, like a teenager that was working there bullied me. And it was, I don't know what he was mad at me about. I think I was having an asthma issue. And he made me stand and spin in a circle until I threw up. Like if that happened now, like that guy would be arrested probably with good reason. Well, you know, that's not tough love. That's not discipline. That's just torture for a kid, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But
I think I got paid once a month there. That's horrible. $180 a month.
How many hours a day?
The kids were bringing me food and beer. Yeah. It was great.
Kids brought you beer? Where'd they get beer?
Yeah. From their parents because they all lived there. Right. You know?
Well, that was a dry town, too. You couldn't buy alcohol there. Totally. And technically, it was illegal to drink it there, but it wasn't really enforced as long as you were in your house. But there was, you know, the term Chautauqua tea?
No, but I can kind of guess what that is.
It's I use that in that thing we wrote about Chautauqua. That's a line. It's a phrase I use in that piece we wrote about Chautauqua. I wrote about Chautauqua on a Viptunia record. What do you think Chautauqua tea is?
Amended tea. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Fortified tea. Yeah, it's little old ladies sitting there with a silver tea set and little, you know, porcelain fine teacups on their porch in Chautauqua drinking booze or booze mixed with tea. Yeah. So it was a common thing there. And my mother sold a lot of
watermelons.
My mother sold a lot of tea sets in her store, the Oriental Bazaar, which you couldn't call a store the Oriental Bazaar now. It would get picketed. Be politically incorrect.
That was a cool store.
It was a great store.
That was a cool store.
Yeah.
Like it just had everything. Like
It did. It had everything made in Asia, from like 10-cent rubber alligators made in, you know, Hong Kong to like, you know, $50,000 Persian rugs. I guess Persian. Is Persian considered Asia? I don't know. It's considered the Orient. Orient was a ethnocentric term meaning not from here, basically.
Right.
It's oriented elsewhere. Yeah. But I had a dream about that place recently. I still have like fond memories and kind of weird, creepy memories. That place was weird. Like that place was old too. That building was from the, you know, Chautauqua started in 1864, I think, as a thing. Like it started as a place to train Sunday school teachers. And it was originally they didn't have buildings. There were just tents.
Right.
And then they kind of added things other than religion to it. It was always been religion and it still is, but they also added like the arts and philosophy, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the fountain in Bester Plaza says four things around it, one on each side. And I think it's the four tenets of Chautauqua. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's like art, religion, philosophy, and maybe science. I think science or knowledge. Yeah.
Snobbiness, I think.
And snobbiness. Yeah. Well, Chautauqua was very snobby. I mean, I got kind of snobbed out of there. It was, it's 1 square mile. It's on Lake Chautauqua, which Chautauqua is an Indian word for bag tight in the middle. I've heard like it's a figure eight shaped lake.
Yeah.
It's like 11 miles long, goes from Mayville to Jamestown. And it either means bag tied in the middle, or I've also heard it means place where one was lost. I kind of like that interpretation of it.
Oh, wow. I never heard that one.
Yeah. But I mean, it attracts people from all over the world. I mean, it's got like the summer orchestra there, you know, like the third violin in that orchestra is the first violin in an orchestra in Cleveland or something. It's got really good everybody. And I grew up, you know, hanging out with students that were my age that were prodigies. Like my first few girlfriends were like, you know, a painting project prodigy, a music prodigy, and a ballerina, you know, ballet prodigy. Like those were the first three girls I met and fell in love with. And I also, that place is in the summer, there's like 30,000 people there. And in the winter, there's like 300. It's really bizarre. You ever been there in the winter?
Oh, yeah.
It's a ghost town. You prefer it, I'll bet. Yeah. Yeah. The speed limit's 5 miles an hour in that whole place. But it was very important to my upbringing of my, I guess, like ability to bond with people and get close to them and get to know them. The fact that it was important for that, the fact that Chautauqua, people are like only there for like 9 weeks, you know, so you don't like most people, it takes like 9 weeks to get to talk to them. In Chautauqua, they're gone in 9 weeks. So you go from, you know, hi, what's your name, to like best friends in a couple hours in Chautauqua, because everyone knows it's going to end. Yep. I remember too, like I was the bad kid. Like I remember, because I smoked pot when I was 12, and you know, I don't smoke pot now, but I smoked pot then. And I had a reputation, like people knew that, or they whispered that, like maybe it was true. I remember one time I was hanging out with this kid my age, and in Chautauqua in their summer house, and it was past curfew and I wasn't supposed to be there. And like his parents came home and they're like, hide under the bed. And it was like, you know, it's like a romance, but we were not doing anything. You know, I wasn't, but we were just hanging out. It was just, I wasn't allowed to be there. And he's just said, like, get under the bed. And I was so like kerfluffled. I just did it. And his mom came in and talked crap about me sitting on the bed with me underneath it. It was a really weird experience. Like I heard from so-and-so that she saw you this afternoon hanging out with that blonde kid from the Oriental Bazaar. He's bad news. You know, it's like, it kind of hurt me. It was really weird. It was, yeah. Interesting. But you know, wow. I'm kicking the world's butt now. And those people are probably nobodies or dead or boring. Worse yet, just living and boring. I'll
sipping
bet you.
Sipping tea on the porch in their silver service that your mom sold them.
I know. Yep. So what do you think of printable guns?
I got to be honest with you. I'm not too familiar with this whole thing.
Okay,
How does that even work?
I thought you were going to say, I don't think that's a good idea. I think it's a great idea. So printable guns. So this guy, Cody Wilson, in 2012, got the idea to 3D print guns. So you know what a 3D printer is?
I'm trying to get my head around it. I can't even picture it.
Who has them?
Where do you get
them? A lot of libraries have them now. When Cody started doing this, a 3D printer cost like $10,000. Now they cost like $500. And he had to rent his first one. And when they found out what he was doing with it, they took it back. Like they sent men over and revoked it and gave him his money back on the spot. So it's basically a box that hooks up to a computer, and it's usually clear. You can see in it, and it's got, you know, XYZ axis motors that move the extruder that kind of like puts this plastic liquid goo into shapes. You know, it can go up, down, left, and right, and you use blueprints to print things. It's not just for guns. That's a very small use of it. I mean, it's used for a lot of hobbyists. There's incredible things you can do with it. It's an incredible technology. Like, for instance, there are communities now where they will upload for free 3D scans that'll work in a printer to print, you know, the spark plug holder for that car you used to have. You know, like, you can't buy parts for some old cars, but if somebody has one, they can scan it and upload it, and other people can print it. They print like artificial limbs with them that are way cheaper than, you know, the ones that people have to pay for. They've printed a heart valve for a heart transplant. It's a groundbreaking technology. It's basically, it gives you the ability to email a thing to somebody.
Wow.
Think about that. What a time to be alive, right?
Wow.
Yeah. Right. So there was, you know, in 2011, 2012, this was starting to get kind of popular, and, you know, there's a big community of it. There's this magazine called Maker Mag that I used to write for. It's like a geek hobbyist magazine, kind of like hardware, software hackers who make things and share the ideas. I've written a couple articles for that. So they were really spreading this 3D printing thing. Like they have a website where you can upload your designs free. People can download them, comment on them, rate them, etc. They gave classes. Maker made a really interesting one. It was called the RepRap, I think, and it's a 3D printer that can print a 3D printer. Like a self-replicating. It prints the parts for it, and then you have to put them together, and then there's like a motor and a couple parts you have to buy. But, you know, it's – I think they're like $300 now, and you can print, you know, for like $50 worth of the goo and, you know, a $50 motor. For like $100, you can now 3D print a 3D printer that can print its own 3D printers. And, yeah. So Cody got the idea – to 3D print a gun, and he wanted to do it as activism to prove that gun laws can't stop guns. That was his primary purpose for it. It was like a political act. And I heard he was going to, and he wasn't even really a gun guy at the time. And he, you know, he'd shot guns. He grew up in Arkansas. He was going to law school in Texas when he had this idea. And it didn't start from guns. It started the way the best ideas start. Like, for instance, I think it's stupid to go into a tattoo parlor and say, I'm going to get a tattoo. What should I get? I have only gotten tattoos the other way around. Like, I need to get this thing. Should I carve it on the wall? Should I get it burned into my face? No, let's get a tattoo. You know, like I'm into the symbol, and then I want it as a tattoo. And Cody wanted to do activism, and he looked around like, what could I do? You know, free speech, guns, et cetera, property rights. And he thought guns. Guns are the thing that are the biggest hot button issue, the thing you could make the biggest splash with. And he came up with this idea that was like so simple and elegant. It was almost boneheaded. It was like, let's 3D print guns and share the files with people. And, you know, he got a little bit of attention. Like, I think Eric S. Raymond wrote about it, who's this hacker Linux guy who's kind of a libertarian. And I saw that and I was like, I'm going to contact this guy and interview him. And I somehow got Cody Wilson's – I think I called the college that he went to and got his email address and contacted him in 2012 and asked him to do an interview. He had not yet made a 3D printed gun, and he – had not done an interview yet. And he told me that he was like, I don't know if I want to do interviews. I think I want to do this just kind of under the radar and be quiet about it. And I gave him a pep talk. I'm like, no, you have to do this. The world needs this. You really need to do this. And I kind of brought him out of his shell a little bit. And now he's like, Mr. I am. It's funny. It's like, it's really beautiful to see the change that's happened in him. I'm not taking credit for it. I just happen to be, you know, the catalyst at the beginning. For a while, I was kind of like, oh, I wish he'd talk more about how I helped him. But now I'm kind of like, eh, the cool people know. And, you know, I don't need, this is going to go to the Supreme Court. Like, I don't need the attention, you know? But in that interview, and it's still up on my Anarchy Gumbo site at kittyfeet.com. I'll link it in the show notes. In that interview, I made a couple suggestions he ended up using. He was stymied on what to do for the firing pin, you know, because he said, you know, I can't print something hard enough to be a firing pin. I think I can print a barrel that'll work for a few shots. And I said, first of all, use a really low caliber, like a 22. He ended up using a 380. I think because it's probably easier with a non-precise firing pin to hit a center fire round than a rim fire, you know, like a 22. But 380 is probably the smallest. 380 is like the smallest you'd really want to carry as a self-defense round. And the thing is, these guns are not good. Later, he got into 3D, into sintering metal and computer-controlled lathes for making metal guns that are actually really usable, but like a copy of a 1911. But it was like a proof of concept. Like, it didn't have to be a good gun. You just had to be able to make it and then fire it once or twice. And that was the proof of concept. So I told him, first of all, the first time you fire it, don't hold it in your hand. Put it on a vise, tie a string to the trigger, and be like 30 feet away behind a brick wall when you pull it, you know, because it might explode. And then the real contribution I think I made, other than telling him you have to do this and you have to be bold, you should be bold about it instead of not worrying about it. The other thing I said was, you know, he's like, I don't know how to print a firing pin. And I'm like, I said, just use a nail. And he said, yeah, but that's cheating. That's not 3D printing. And I'm like, it's not cheating. The point is to make something that anybody can make anywhere in the world. Anybody in the world can get a nail, you know, they're everywhere. You can pull one out of your house if you want to. So they did that. And about 6 months later, he made his first 3D printed gun, and he put a video up on YouTube of him firing it and explaining it. And it just went viral. I mean, it like every news organization in the world wanted to talk to him about it. And then, you know, he was sharing the 3D files for it. And then the State Department of the United States government told him to stop sharing the files. They said that he was violating some act about like giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Like, you know, exporting weapons to non-friendly countries, because, you know, anybody anywhere could download this. Like, it was basically, they were talking about charging him with the same thing that you would get if you sold a rocket launcher to Syria, you know, and you weren't the government. So he took the files down, but it was too late. The cows were out of the barn. And everybody started sharing the files, like everyone else, like Pirate Bay and a lot of sites. And people were sharing these files who never shot a gun. It was just like, oh, it's naughty and they're telling me not to do it, so I'll do it. So this is what governments don't realize, and what statists who want to ban things they don't like don't realize, is that the more you try to pass laws against something, the more of it there will generally be. Isn't that weird? It's true, though, especially if it's something that anyone can do. It doesn't cost anything to do. And you're told you can't do it. It's called the Streisand effect. Do you know that term? Huh.
No, not familiar with that.
Well, Barbara Streisand lives on this, you know, $100 million house on the coast of Malibu in California. And somebody was taking aerial photography. It was like some science organization was mapping the coastline from airplanes. This is like before drones. This is like 20 years ago or something, before drones were available at Walmart. And we're sending airplanes up and taking still photos and then creating collages and sharing them online, maybe not even online yet, but, you know, in a library somewhere. I think it was online, or maybe you could like send away and they'd send them all to you on a disc or something, because it was big, a lot of data. And they were mapping the shoreline of California. And then doing it again, like every year, to show erosion, to measure erosion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pictures showed like the houses that are on the shore. And she owns this house that's on the shore. She has a private beach. And she got really mad. Like, she didn't want – she felt it was an invasion of privacy to have this scientific organization showing pictures of her yard, you know, and she tried to sue them. And when at the point she tried to sue them, the picture of her property had been downloaded 11 times. After she tried to sue them and this became a news piece, it got downloaded like 1.5 million times. That's the Streisand effect. If you try to stop something that you can't stop, you'll make more of it. And that's what's happening with Cody Wilson. And it's like in the time since 2012, I interviewed him. About 6 months later, 2013, he came out with a printed gun. Since then, he's actually started selling this thing that's like a you know what a CNC milling device is? Computer.
No.
Numerical controlled. It's basically like how they make things like precise metal parts on a lathe now or on a cutting machine. Like it's the same idea. You download this little text file that's the blueprint, you feed it in the computer, and it tells the machine where to cut the metal. And he actually made a little box that he sells for, I don't know, I think it's over $1,000, but it's called the Ghost Gunner, and it prints all of the parts. So with an AR-15, there's this thing you can get called a 80% lower. So all of the parts for an AR-15 can be ordered online without any permits or background checks, except for the lower, which is the part that's considered the gun. You know, it's where the trigger mechanism and the firing chamber and firing pin are. And you can actually buy a chunk of metal of like, you know, titanium grade aluminum for, I don't know, 50, 60 bucks online. That is, it's called an 80% lower. And it's that thing. It's a block of aluminum that's got some holes drilled in it that has to have the other 20% of the holes drilled. And then it can be a functioning rifle if you buy the parts that anyone can buy. So it's kind of a way that people, you know, can make guns that are very accurate and very powerful, make rifles without dealing with, you know, nosy people knowing what they have. And he's been selling – he can't keep up with the orders on those. There's so many orders of those. And he wrote a book about all this that's on Random House or something like that. He mentions me in it. He mentions that I did the first interview with him, and he mentions that I told him about – I don't know if he came up with the idea for the – his first gun was called the Liberator. I don't know if I did talk with him. I told him about the Liberator. Oh, he knew about the Liberator, but I told him I'd seen one in a museum. Liberator was a like – $5 stamped one-shot pistol that the U.S. government made in World War II to drop into Nazi Germany for the Jews to use to like shoot Nazis in the back of the head and take their rifle. So he used the name that, the Liberator, for the first 3D printed gun he made. So yeah, so that's – it actually has been back in the news because the State Department, after years of like – you know, I mean, they were talking about prosecuting him, even though he'd stopped doing it, for what he did previously of sharing these files. And they just issued this statement a week or two ago saying like, oh, it's cool now. Cody can do that. It's fine. So he started sharing them again. It started getting a lot of press again. And then they had this emergency judgment in Pennsylvania of a federal judge said you can't distribute these, a temporary injunction. So it's – I mean he's on CBS News. Like they, you know, interviewed him nationally. Like everyone's interviewing him again. And I'd kind of forgotten about printable guns. But all of a sudden, like the news is making sure everyone who's never heard of them has heard of them. You know, like, oh, this threat, we must stop. And it's polarizing. And the hilarious thing about this that a lot of people I think don't realize is that – these aren't good guns, and most people could go in their garage and make a better gun right now, you know, using pipes and metal and string, and you can make a zip gun. You know, it is a zip gun. It's a zip gun with a trigger that fires one shot, but they're not good guns. They're not very accurate. There's not rifling or you know, it's plastic barrel, thick plastic barrel, and they're really not something that people are going to make and use in crimes and get away with. The idea, it's just the idea that you could make a gun. Now, his ghost gunner thing, you could make, you know, working AR-15s with it. And before he made, before he succeeded in making a printable gun, his first thing was making printable, like 30 round mags. And he named them after politicians that, try to ban people from owning 30 round mags. Like he had one called the Feinstein and one called the Schumer. So yeah, that's what's going on. What do you think of all that?
It's a lot to take in, man.
Yeah. I know.
It's hard to get, you know, my head around.
I think
back to my grandfather's hardware store where he sold dynamite. Anything twice about it.
Yeah. Know? He sold rifles?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good rifles? First 22s.
Rifle. Yeah.
What was your first rifle? A Marlin 60?
It was a little Remington 22. I never hunted, but I
was it like
that was the one?
A 3/4 size?
It was the one I used to rifle? Take to school with me.
Yeah.
What's that?
Was it a 3/4 size rifle? Like a little one? Short one?
No, it was a regular. I mean, it was regular.
Because they make ones for kids. You ever seen I call them Billy's first rifle. They make, I think Remington makes one. They're like 3/4 the length of a normal 22. They're 22 short only, and they're bolt action. You know, it's like for kids to like really young kids, like 6 or 7 to start using rifles with supervision. And they're bolt action to kind of slow you down, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, man. Wow.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
And go on the sidebar of the Freedom Fiend site. We now have Amazon links for Amazon US, Amazon UK, and Amazon Canada due to popular demand. Worms.
This is Mr. Michael Dean. Tune in next week for the thrilling conclusion of the second half of this super long, cool interview with Phil Warmoth of Biptunia on the Freedom Fiends. Worms.